being more of an enabler rather than the controller, you have to look at customers, where do they need help? Building an organization is a marathon. Good ideas come from every corner of the organization. The timing is never going to be right.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Breakout CEO Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Holman, and I get the pleasure of speaking with so many interesting and successful people. And it's an absolute joy for me to bring some of these behind-the-scenes moments to you, the audience, so you can also share in you know, learning from and just getting to know some of the people who've made these interesting pivotal decisions in their business. And today we get the pleasure of talking with Vikas Singhal. Vikas, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah, it's good to have you. You've got a very interesting background with a couple, you know, big, I'll call them big milestones or big moments in there, and one that you're working on now. I think we can see it on the back wall behind you there, HyperDart, right? So that's
yes,
the current venture. We'll get into that here in this show. But I want to frame this because we were talking before we hit record, and I think that there's an aspect to this show that, you know, we'll probably dive into along the way, that is, I'm hearing it more and more with the CEOs on the show and off the show. People are talking of not only about the successes, right? They're talking about the big moments in the business or the things that broke in the business, but they're also talking about, you know, kind of the personal behind the scenes side of being a CEO, you know, self-actualization you mentioned, or mindfulness, those types of things. And so I think it's, you know, perfectly appropriate if the conversation leads that way. We can bring up some of those things that more and more CEOs are talking about and working into their, you know, their very busy schedules, their routines and their lifestyles. So I think I could add an interesting aspect to what we talk about today, because.
Sure. Absolutely.
Fantastic.
Looking forward to it.
Fantastic. Now I have to ask though first, just to start off, because people love to hear like the you know, what are the big wins, right? And so you were, maybe we'll just frame this as you spent about 20 years as a CEO at Nagarro, and Nagarro just had a great big exit, right? Did I get that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. You know, Nagarro's, you know, it's like your first baby. You know, we started this with my friends from college, with my brother, and you know, we were 20 somethings. You know, just jumped into it. You know, without you know, like a clear strategy or execution plan or something, and you know, it was just, you know, late night weekends to begin with, and then, you know, just 100% dived in. So it was more of, you know, just an extension of college life. You know, we were just hanging out in the living room, writing code, and, you know, trying to figure things out as, you know, as, you know, on a day-to-day basis. So it was very different from, you know, like a planned strategy, vision, you know, those kind of things. And it just evolved. I think a lot of it had to do with, you know, with the fun and camaraderie in the
yeah.
group. I think the initial team, the founders, they gelled well together. And then, you know, slowly it grew into, you know, an enterprise and had a life of its own. And yeah, I was CEO there for the first, you know, close to 20 years of its life, you know, right, starting out of our living room to a big company. I stepped out of that role when I think the company was close to $100 million in revenue. But it kept growing even, you know, without me. So I don't know how much credit I deserve for it. Very recently touched about $1 billion. So it was a great story, you know, great outcome for the company. Above all, you know, great relationships that I built over the course of this 20 years. Both with the founders, with the employees, with our partners, and with our clients. I think those relationships are what I cherish the most from this experience.
Yeah, I love that. And I want to ask, I want to go back. I don't want to skip over the $1 billion valuation and all that stuff, because that's, you know, that that's important. And you clearly had a huge hand in that, even though you're downplaying it right now, I think a little bit. But when you talk about starting with your friends, I talked to some CEOs, and I think they're more frustrated CEOs, because they're like, man, I really want to just get my team on board. You know, I don't know that they're looking for this family type environment like you hear about, but you want to work with people who are equally excited about working together, perhaps, as they are about achieving, you know, some big business milestone, right? And it sounds like that's something that you guys found early on. And I don't know if you started with pitch decks or not, but you, but you're like, hey, we're gonna build something. We don't know what, but we'll build something, and it'll be fun to work together.
Yeah, I think the team dynamics is really important, and I personally don't look at it as family. But what I have found most important is a shared value system. You know, and you basically have to even step beyond like the vision for the company or something like that. I think you have to go to a more you know, core decision making process, which I think comes from our value system.
Yeah.
You know, how do you value, for example, you know, what do you value most? You know, relationships, for example. It could be, you know, some people for, you know, it might be the yardsticks that are more important, you know, hitting certain numbers, or for others, it might just be, you know, the, you know, the execution aspects that are most important.
Yeah.
For some, it might be the vision or the why of, you know, what you're trying to achieve. So I think a shared value system really is the most important thing, because it affects a lot of the decision making in the company, and how everybody is able to agree on those shared decisions.
What were some of the shared values that you think your team at Nagarro, your initial team, was able to build on over the years?
So I could tell you about myself, and you know, I'm hoping that a lot of the other co-founders and management team would agree with it. You know, I personally value excellence and humility. Those are, you know, the two most important driving values for me personally. And you know, I would just dare to say that that was shared between a lot of the other team members, you know, people that we brought on board with our co-founders as well. You know, just trying to produce the best product possible, and you know, being humble about it. You know, not be the one, you know, taking all the credit. You know, you know, give credit where credit is due. You know, make it more about the team effort rather than the individual effort. So that I think was a shared value system within the core of the organization.
Yeah, I can see that. And when you, as you're describing humility, you know, I always wonder how people define sort of, like, do you define excellence the same? You know, is it just a normal definition, or is there some specific excellence you guys are working towards? But when you're talking about humility, I've always thought of humility as this kind of internal thing, you know, like I might not want to flaunt my successes, or I might acknowledge my successes in a humble way, you know, and both of those might be kind of an internal humility. But as you're talking about it, it really made me think that there's another aspect to humility, especially when you're in a team environment. That is, you know, being humble enough, not just to not flaunt your stuff or to, you know, to take credit or responsibility where you should, but also give credit where credit is due to other team members who've accomplished great things. Is that part of being humble in a team environment for you?
Just a quick note about our guests. I host the Breakout CEO podcast to share behind the scenes insights from scaling businesses. As an attorney, I see the real challenges leaders face long before success becomes public. But client stories have to stay confidential. So we invite guest CEOs to share their own moments of struggle and success. I'm so grateful to our guests and my team at Intellectual Strategies for making this show possible. Now, let's get back to the show.
I see a lot of, you know, hero worship, you know, like the CEO deserves whatever, that it's their vision, they led the company and all that. And, you know, some of that might be true. But what I've noticed is that, you know, good ideas come from every corner of the organization. You know, human beings, I think, you know, by and large have, I would say, you know, about this very similar level of capabilities, you know, what one human being can do, most human beings can do. And it's just, you know, and sometimes it's all about the ideas. And I've noticed that good ideas come from, you know, they don't have to come from the top. You know, you'll get it from across the organization. And if you're not listening to that, then you're missing out on on a big part of, you know, what your human resource pool is capable of doing. And, you know, sometimes it is just small ideas that you just implement well, and they end up making a big difference. And sometimes it's, you know, it's just that motivation or that drive that one individual within the organization can do, and that kind of, you know, rallies the entire organization behind it. So, so I've seen a lot of these things happen within the organization that that I feel like, you know, no one individual deserves that much credit for the success of a complete organization.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to write a note down on this here shortly. You're making me. Would you say that for a CEO who feels like they're carrying the burden themselves, maybe there is an opportunity to step back and say, maybe there's a humility thing going on here too. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, that's human nature. You know, we want to, first of all, we want to believe that we're in control all the time. and then second of all, we want to claim, we want to be the author of our successes.
Yeah.
And both of these things, I think age has kind of taught me that, we're not always in control. We're not always, the authors of our own destiny. A lot of things have to line up. We can only, create the right environment where good things would happen and just allow it to play out. And we also beat ourselves down for every failure. So I think just doing our best, creating the right environment, getting the right people in the room who share your values, and, you know, allowing them to do their best work. So as long as, you know, we're not really, controlling in every aspect of it, you know, we're more allowing things to happen and creating the right environment for that. I think
curating instead of controlling.
Yes.
Okay.
And curating also to the extent of, you know, getting the right people in the room, maybe asking the right questions, instilling in others the confidence to to express themselves or to come up with the ideas.
Yeah.
So being more of an enabler rather than the controller, I think that would help in creating an environment of success, and also I think would be less stressful for CEOs, in my opinion.
Less, maybe counterintuitively, less stressful for some, right? They're like, no, I have to control this. Yeah. So I can control my stress, when in fact they're contributing to their stress more than controlling their stress.
Yeah. So,
well, I'd love to know, because I want to get into HyperDart story too, but I don't want to skip over the Nagarro story. I mean, 20 years as a CEO. You clearly went through, you know, what we're on this show starting to call the breakout arc, right? Breakout arc is where a CEO and a team, you start building something and it's working, you're getting momentum, and then something breaks. And, mm-hmm. And when it breaks, you've got to reevaluate, reassess, maybe think back on new paradigms or new perspectives to come out with a new insight that you can act on and you know, get past that pivotal moment to what we call the breakthrough, which is the outcome of the of your breakout moment. So that build, break, breakout, breakthrough cycle, you know, is there a moment in time or a part of that life cycle in Nagarro that stands out as, man, we had momentum and then things just went sideways. And you had, like, is there something that stands out that you could draw on for the audience to hear a little bit of the behind the scenes?
Sure. The one time period that really comes front center for me is the 2008 financial crisis. So that was the first real test for the company. We'd had a good run before that. We were acquiring new customers. We were delivering good solutions.
And for the audience, sorry to interrupt, but for the audience who hasn't heard what Nagarro did, can you give them just a brief overview of that?
Yeah. So Nagarro, in a very simplistic term, it was a bespoke software application development firm. But the way we approached it was, we were part like a high-end management consulting company, which would go in and, look at business problems in large enterprise clients. One part was, I would say, algorithmic problem solving. So that is what I think our secret sauce was, that we look at a tough business problem, build some compelling algorithms around it. And the third piece was the actual software development and implementation. And we packaged these three pieces together, in a very tight, cohesive way, where we would go into large Fortune 500 enterprise clients, look at, tough business problems, solve them through, building algorithms, whether it was, some kind of scheduling or optimization, stochastic programming, or some data science related solution before it was called AI, and package it all together, and build these solutions that had very, very real impact on our customers, whether it was, improving their efficiency or improving top line benefits, or cost reductions or other forms of efficiency that actually made them competitive in the marketplace. So we were kind of like a secret weapon for a lot of these enterprise clients that helped them become more competitive.
No surprise then that a company with that type of deep expertise and background would be doing pretty well in today's economy, right? So when you hit the 2008 financial crisis, was that a direct impact on your company, or was it more of an impact on your typical client, economics and the ability to hire you? How did that come into play?
I mean, if if you were in a professional career at that time, I mean, it was a lot of doom and gloom. Yeah. I don't know, you know, maybe not so much for your audience who are younger, but it was a lot of doom and gloom. You know, the stock market had tanked. You know, people didn't know if, for example, banking would survive, and as a consequence, whether, you know, there would be more systemic issues in the U.S. economy and world economy in general. So there was a lot of doom and gloom. And, you know, looking back, it feels more like a blip. But, you know, if you're living through it, you know, you do tend to panic and say, you know, okay, you know, what is going to survive and what is not when big banks were failing around you. So yes, we did have clients who put the brakes on because they didn't know what to expect, you know, how their business would be impacted. Mm-hmm. And consequently, you know, our revenue took a nosedive as well. So it was one of those moments where, you know, you have to decide whether, you know, do you have to start laying off people? You know, well, how do you go back and talk to the customers and see what, you know, how you can restore that lost business and so on and so forth. So, so that was, I would say, a big moment in the life of the company that, and as we came out of it, I think we had this maturity phase. But one of the learnings from that is, so first of all, we were able to avoid layoffs at the time. So we did across the board pay cut rather than laying off. You know, the management took the maximum pay cut. So the way we implemented it was, you know, the bottom layer, you know, had the least amount of pay cuts. And as you went up the ranks, you know, you took bigger and bigger pay cuts. So we implemented that rather than doing a layoff.
Was that a function of your team values? I mean, your leadership values, like
exactly. I mean, it was just one of those things. You know, as things were going well, you know, we were sharing that with the employees. You know, we were growing and all of that. And you know, when things took a nosedive, we said, you know, it was easy to say, okay, you know, these projects are cut and hence you lay off certain staff. But instead, what we decided was, you know, we're not going to do that. We're not going to, you know, take a scalpel and cut teams, but rather, you know, we're going to just do across the board pay cuts so that we reduce our expenses. But at least we do not let go of people just because of, and these were, you know, great employees who were doing a great job and just landed in a bad environment. And people who were laid off at the time, you know, didn't find work for at least a year after that. So we were actually glad that we did what we did. The other, you know, because, you know, as we came out of that, the cohesion with the team, with the employees, with the management, I think that was just extraordinary.
Just solidified that the culture, I'm sure. To
like, yeah.
I'm curious, just a side question here. Were you guys bootstrap funded? I mean, how were you funded at this time? Because a lot of, you know, the play for VC funded companies these days is hire, fire, fast. Both are fast. I know people say hire. What do they say? Hire slow, fire fast. But VC funded company is hire fast, fire fast. It seems like, right?
No, we did not have external investors. You know, we were primarily we got into revenue fairly quickly, and you know, we were able to bootstrap. You know, we got funding much later in the life of the company. So at that time we did not have that external pressure, and I think to some extent. That is true that, you know, we did not have that kind of investor pressure. I mean, the biggest investors were, essentially the management of the company. The other learning from that phase was, how you look at your clients. I think up until that time, at least my thinking was, very transactional with the customers. We're delivering value, we're getting paid for it, and so on and so forth, which was all great. I think customers valued what we did for them, and we had long term relations with the customers, but at that time, I think one of the thinkings that changed for us as an organization is that we really started looking at how we can help the customers. Not looking at, okay, here's an opportunity. Like when you look at your Salesforce or your CRM, you say, okay, what are the opportunities, right? And you call them opportunities.
Where's the money? That's what that means, right? Where's the money?
There's the money. You can go after this, and then you put salespeople after those opportunities. But then the learning was that you have to look at customers and where do they need help, and where is it that we can help, and the money will follow, the opportunity will follow, that project will follow, but you lead with that kind of thinking. Here's a customer, how can we help them improve their top line or their bottom line, improve their efficiency, or just go in with that consulting hat rather than the salesperson hat, and really talk to the customer to understand their pain points. I know it's very cliche to say that, but living through it is actually quite different. I mean, I'd heard these terms before, but we always looked at opportunities like, okay, here's a $1 million deal that we can get, or here's rather than saying, okay, we looked at this client and we identified, this pain point that the customer has, and we would be the ideal to solve this because we have this expertise to solve these kind of problems that we've done in the past. We have the technology expertise, we have the the algorithmic expertise. We have the right consultants with that domain knowledge who can actually step in and help the customer. And once we started, putting that front and center, I think those relationships just became so much stronger. New relationships, were so much easier to get. Rather than leading with salespeople, we would lead with the domain experts who would go in and just to understand the customer's pain points. And that was the right time for that because a lot of customers had pain points. Either their revenue was declining or their financing was getting pulled, or there were things that were, or they had to shrink their teams and had to do more with less. So it was kind of like an ideal time for that mindset and that kind of thinking, which really helped in your terms, like was that breakthrough,
that breakout. Sounds very much like what's that book, the Challenger Sale, I think, where the idea of sales isn't selling, it's identifying problems and solving those. I'm curious, what did your team look like at that time, and how did you reorient them towards this this approach of identifying problems, especially in the sense that I think a lot of earlier stage companies say to themselves, well, how do I identify a problem until I have a relationship with the client, and how do I get a relationship until I've got something to sell them? And so doesn't it all start with this, like, don't I have to start with the sales pitch to get the underlying strategic observations? Like, what did that look like on your team? How did you go from one approach to the other?
I mean, getting customers, I mean, it's always hard getting customers, but But you do get customers' ear. I mean, you could be at a trade show and run into a potential customer. It's just how you start that conversation. It's so important. The person on the other side, they can feel it. They can totally feel how you're approaching it. You know, really approaching it to understand what the customer's pain point is, or are you just, digging in to see, where the opportunity
when can I wait, when can I make my pitch, right?
Yeah.
Do you want to buy?
Right. So I mean, you can start by saying, oh, we are this and we have this product and we have these features, or we've done these kind of implementation for other clients and we can do this but the customer, has a specific pain point, and you might just be bombarding them with and totally shutting them off, rather than just asking the right question. Okay, what's going on in your org, and where are some of the challenges that you're facing? Just starting with those kind of open-ended questions, totally changes the dynamic of the conversation and how the customer approaches it. And there have been so many instances where we went in and identified an opportunity, or a pain point, but figured that we're not the right people for this. And we would say, why don't you try some of this off-the-shelf product, rather than building something that might be more risky, more time-consuming, more expensive. Here's something that you can try out. And that goodwill will last years. They would come back and say, that was the right advice, and we followed through. But then here's something that we would like you to work on. So clients would come back, just because we weren't overly salesy. We were genuinely looking at the client and trying to see what was the best way to solve their problem. And I think that just makes a huge difference. And you were asking how we approached the org and all of that. Mm-hmm. Some of it is just how the sales organization is both organized and incentivized. And so we paired salespeople with, the consultant grade, problem solvers. So the salespeople are helping set up the initial meetings, but then, we have these domain experts who are, just going in to understand customers' problems. So, I don't think it's rocket science, but it's harder to do it on a day-to-day basis when you're actually having that conversation. Are you really trying to understand and solve a customer's problem, or trying to close that deal?
Check the box. Always be closing, right?
Yeah.
Two different. Do you think that approach that you guys kind of switch that you made back in the 2008-ish timeframe, that helped build the foundation that Nagarro is built on today?
I'd like to believe that. I mean, I've been out of the company for the last few years, but I know enough folks there. So I think the DNA of the company has stayed pretty intact over the years. We've done several acquisitions, and after my time, we've done even bigger acquisitions. And what I've seen is that, just from an integration perspective, a lot of that, the acquisitions also have kind of followed the same value system and DNA, because a lot of the other entrepreneurs who have joined Nagarro as part of the acquisitions, they kind of have very similar values and their way of thinking and their way of running the company. And I think that is also one of the learnings, is, doing acquisitions right, is, getting that DNA fit is the most important
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. So what did you do after transitioning from your position at Nagarro? Did you go straight into HyperDart, or did you, what did that look like?
So I actually took a couple of years off. I kind of, tapered off my role. I stepped down from CEO. I was kind of like, doing part-time work with Nagarro as more like a consultant or just helping. And then before, fully disconnecting. And during that time, I also, some of it was just recharging your batteries and spending time with family. But it was also, I'm a builder at heart. I'm a technologist. My years at Nagarro, I've kind of been disconnected from that. As the organization grows, you're more disconnected from the day-to-day technology. I hadn't written code in years. So it was, part of it was also relearning, technology, the newest, the latest and greatest, tech stuff, and just becoming more hands-on, technologist. So I did that. I was also exploring different ideas, what I wanted to do next. I wanted to be in the consumer tech space, and that was just one of my draws. And so I took the time to explore, different ideas and relearn technology, recharge a little bit before jumping into HyperDart.
It seems like a common stage for people who've had, kind of a long run at something. And then they say, I want to do something else, but maybe not right this minute. Let me recharge. Maybe reconnect with family. I don't know. Yeah. Some people feel like they need more time with family and you mentioned you've done some marathons and things like that. Is that the time frame when you're like, I'm going to run a few marathons?
Yeah, around that time. I think I've been ignoring personal health as well. I put literally everything on a back burner. When we were doing Nagarro, and so it was time to reconnect with family, also, focus a little bit on health. And yes, that was the time when I, started running, did my first marathon, then a few years later, second one. So it was good to not have that constant pressure on your head.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to ask, which marathons did you run and which was your favorite?
I mean, I've only run the Napa Valley Marathon because it's right.
That's beautiful.
In our backyard, and it's beautiful. And it's considered a beginner's marathon because it's fairly flat. I did it with very little training, so I didn't follow like any standard training routines or anything.
Oh, that's funny. I have a friend one time. I've run. I was going to run my 12th marathon during COVID, but COVID hit and they canceled it. And I haven't been back much since. I'm doing, tennis and soccer a lot more these days.
Which is your favorite marathon?
My favorite marathon? It's probably got to be the Ogden Marathon. It ranks high in the marathons across the country. It's here 30 minutes north of
Utah?
Me in Utah. And you start in the mountains. You run down, past a reservoir and then down through a canyon into Ogden City. And they've been doing it for 25 or 30 years or something like that. So it's, by default, I've done that one five or six times. So that's my favorite, but it really is a beautiful, the downhill's nice. I've done some that have more downhill and they just kill your legs. So, but Napa would be beautiful to run through.
And they have nice wine in the end. So I think you start in Calistoga and you end in Napa, and at the end of it, there's like wine tasting.
If I get back into it, which I might someday, that might be one to go on the list. So, that's an important thing, and I love, I don't know, I connect with people who run. especially because I know that people who've gone out and run these long distances, you adopt this different mindset, I think, when you start to say to yourself, man, I just, like 3 miles used to be hard, or 6 miles or whatever it was used to be hard. And I just did 13 or 20 or 26. And you start to, I think it changes your perspective on a lot of things. You know, you start to look at problems differently. I've had a lot of problems kind of go away. By the time I hit mile 12, I'm like, that's not that big of a deal anymore. We'll fix it. It'll be okay. But when I started my run at mile 1 and 2, I was like, I don't know if I can keep running. I got to take care of this thing. And by mile 12, it's like, yeah, we'll figure it out. So I don't know. It's a perspective thing, I think.
Oh, I think it's, you touched upon a very important point. I think for entrepreneurs and CEOs, it's very important because, building an organization is a marathon. You know, you're going to run into, so many challenges, so many steps. It is kind of like running a marathon. It's definitely not a sprint, right? And, you're not like going full speed for like, 10 seconds or 30 seconds to do 100 meters. You're going to have those ups and downs. You're going to have those challenges, and it's just that that grit that keeps you going. The constant reminder, like, okay, 1 mile at a time, one step at a time.
And everybody's got to put in 50,000 steps or whatever that is. You can't finish the marathon without putting in about the same number of steps as everybody else. It's just a matter of maybe how fast you did it and what was your stride or whatever, right?
Right. So I think there are a lot of parallels. I mean, it's just having the patience. Sometimes it's not going too fast initially because you're just going to burn out. And
I've done that.
It's important to keep that even keel and look at it one step at a time. And
getting back to where we started here, like having a group of friends to run with, that's always a lot of fun too. Running by yourself there's some mindfulness, there's some self-reflection that happens in there, maybe some self-pity sometimes, but having a group of friends, I've done that, and it makes the run very different than when you run by yourself. So
right. Another thing that I've seen, whether it is running or anything else, achieving something that you once thought was difficult to achieve, and it could be little things. It doesn't have to be, running a marathon. It could be like little things, but they build upon itself. In your mind, you feel like, okay, I did this, now I can do that. And I think it's so important for business and for entrepreneurs, I would say, because, you're constantly running into challenges. So you have to have something to fall back on. Like I ran the marathon, which I thought was impossible. And that kind of reinforces like, okay, I have another challenge, but I know that I have overcome challenges in the past. And just that memory of it makes you more effective at dealing with the next challenge. So I advise, my kids and, other fellow entrepreneurs as well, is to start building that memory of challenges that you've overcome. And sometimes we overcome challenges and just forget about it. But I think it's important to kind of remember those, because the next time you face it, you have something to fall back on. You kind of say like, okay, I had that challenge and I overcame that. And hence, you have that confidence to take on the new one.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, it took me many, many commitments to get to my first marathon finish. But after doing one, you're like, well, I know I can do it now. It's not a question of whether I can do it. It's just a question of, how am I going to do the next one? And I wonder if that leads into kind of your next venture with HyperDart. Like at some point, you'd had some time off, you'd done a little bit of running, and you're like, I'm going to tackle another really big problem, right? Is that How did that come about when you said, I think I'm ready for something else?
Yeah, so HyperDart, I mean, of all the ideas that I was evaluating, HyperDart was probably the most difficult one, the most, you know, hairy-ass problem that I
really
could think of. Yeah. And that was primarily the reason why I was kind of like, I didn't even think about it. I said, you know, too difficult, too big, you know, too hairy. Let's look at some of these other ones.
How were you framing the problem that HyperDart would be tackling?
So HyperDart was, you know, a new take on search. So the problem that we'd identified was that search was broken in two different ways. So if you think about it, there are people who are looking for information and there are people who create information mm-hmm. or knowledge, right? And the search engine kind of sits in the middle, you know, directing traffic or creating these indexes of the pages and so on and so forth. And in the process, creating a lot of friction, friction in the sense that, since if we go to traditional search, it was primarily keyword-based search. Mm-hmm. So there were ways to game that system. You know, you could do keyword stuffing, you could do backlinks, because search engines would prioritize things that had links from other sites.
Right.
So there were ways to game the system. The marketers were constantly in a cat and mouse chase with the search engine. They would update the algorithm, and then you would have to, you know, modify your pages so that they would look more relevant to the search engine. Or you pay to advertise and appear on the top. Yeah. So there's a lot of that kind of friction. And then you also did not want to share all the information with the search engine because you finally want the user to click to the site so that then you can monetize that traffic by showing more ads or putting a paywall and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of friction in the system. And our goal was to eliminate that a lot of that friction by making search more like a platform where the knowledge creators essentially plug in their information. Mm-hmm. And the search engine, which HyperDart, monetizes that information and shares revenue back with the creators. So, you know, which is a totally different way of looking at search. So search is no longer a black box that, you know, you have to pay to get ranked up.
Yeah.
But rather a platform where the creators share their knowledge and they get to monetize and make money off of it. Rather than trying to take the traffic to their site and then putting more ads, more paywall. The search results page is the easiest to monetize, has the highest monetization rates, and yet the search engine essentially takes all the dollars.
Are you saying that, because I think a lot of people who've, you know, we've all used search for decades now, and a lot of us just superficially would say, well, search is really easy. But I love that you've taken this almost counterintuitive position that says, no, search is really full of friction and it's way, way messier or harder than it should be. It sounds like what you're saying is that a lot of it centers around this middleman position of Google or whatever search yep. engine that exists out there. So even though Google has created the power for us to all search way more quickly, it's still much more friction driven than it should be. That's what you're saying.
Yeah. And most of the, if you think about most of the information that you get, in search is very, superficial information. Most of the, real knowledge is either hidden behind paywalls or, you know, you have to go to specific sites where yes. you know, they want to monetize using ads. If I were a creator, I would not want all that information to show up in search results page or be AI summarized.
Because then nobody goes to your site, right?
Yeah, then nobody goes to your site. And these days, that is the big friction that is happening is between the AI summarization and the knowledge creator. So LLMs will read your blogs, your recommendations, your articles, and all of that, and are able to summarize that, which is great for the user, but not great for the person who created that knowledge, because they don't get to participate in the economics of it.
Yeah. Did you have to get into building this? Like, I know a lot of these times working with inventors who really, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, there's this new system. And they think at a really high level, they want something that works better, you know, generally. But to really identify the innovation moments, you have to get into the details. You have to say, well, this system only works if you do all of these things. I don't know, maybe analogizing back to the marathon, you know that, like, I know that mile 8 is going to be difficult and miles 16 to 19, I'm going to have to push. But I only know that because I've been through the process. And I think you have to find those innovative moments. A lot of times you have to go from the high level, I'm going to run a marathon, to, okay, what does it feel like to run mile 8? Or what does it feel like to push through, you know, that and try to find your second wind after mile 16? Did you just hypothesize that this is, there's a problem here, there's friction? Or were you in the middle of building to kind of discover these friction points?
So we had a fairly good idea of, what the problems with the research ecosystem are. And growing up, in college in the 90s and, you know, early career in the mid to late 90s, we were very familiar with search evolving, because that was, you know, the time when search kind of, the genesis of what modern search and Google became. And my college thesis was on internet search and limited space and memory algorithm that we built. This is going back to early 90s. I've kind of, search has stayed with me for years. I mean, it was always a problem that I thought of in my spare time, and so it's not something that that just, you know, okay, I want to do a new company, you know, why not do search? So even at Nagarro, we'd seen a lot of our clients were marketing organizations at big Fortune 500 companies, so we knew how they struggled to get traffic or user acquisition, how much effort they would put in to get ranked on search engines.
You were in the details all along then.
Search was something that that I've kind of thought of very, very intimately for years. And that was probably the reason why I didn't want to do this startup until, you know, it kind of, the idea essentially caught me by the collar and kind of pulled me in. But it is a very difficult problem to solve. It is very hairy. It has, a lot of, both in terms of data, in terms of the compute requirements, in terms of, the different aspects, you know, there's localization, there's users from different areas who access it. So search is a very, very, very complicated problem. And all kudos to Google for doing such an amazing job with search. They've truly done an excellent, excellent job. It's just that, we're out to make it smoother, more egalitarian, more equitable for the actual creators of knowledge. I think they suffer in this ecosystem, and you can't really blame Google for it, because Google it's a monopoly, so they can they would maximize their revenue, and they don't need to share revenue with anybody. Yeah. But we feel that it can be made better. if only there is more revenue sharing. So think of search more like a platform that takes a small cut from the revenue. Mm-hmm. Then it's really a platform where knowledge creators share their knowledge and information. That would actually improve the user's experience as well, because things that are otherwise, the richer parts of the content that are typically behind paywalls, the creators are more incentivized to bring that into search. So search is no longer this two-step thing where you find something, you click through, and then you monetize. You can bring your knowledge, you can present a richer interface to the end user, because you can then monetize it right on the search platform.
Is that kind of where the word hyperdart comes from? You're getting deeper, you're getting more pointed responses in your search results, like more targeted.
More targeted, yes, exactly.
Okay. Okay. And that makes sense. Well, what have you seen? What have been some of the milestones that you've celebrated so far in HyperDart? And what are, what's one or two of the maybe breaking moments that you've had to face so far?
I think let me start with the challenges. I think when we started out, I think one of the mistakes that we made was we didn't anticipate how fast AI would transform things. So we were actually doing more incremental improvements to search and, building the platform. And then suddenly, with the AI wave that turned the tables in terms of, making more things possible, I think we did not read the tea leaves as early. So that I think was, now we've completely transformed the product to be AI first. and in terms of breakthrough moments in our current journey, I think we're still a small company, so I wouldn't really say that we've had those kind of breakthrough moments, but I'll give you like small examples that we do searches where we because of the partners that we have in our ecosystem, we are able to generate results that are far superior to what you would get in traditional search, because traditional search just does it just produces links, or it produces AI summaries, which are also primarily text-based summaries. So we are able to generate answer cards. Now we've also built our own SDK that can be used by third parties to build what we call darts on our platform. So these are almost like interactive answer cards. Very soon we're going to open it up to third-party developers. So I think that would be a breakthrough moment when you can actually build integrations into search. So third-party developers will be able to take our developer kit and be able to build answer cards, which are called darts, on our platform, and then just publish them. So think of it as an app store ecosystem almost, where third parties can publish these darts. Because if you think about the search result page as a canvas, do you want just one company to be producing all the widgets and things on the canvas, or just producing AI summaries, when you can have hundreds of thousands of these creators or knowledge creators or publishers who can create these intelligent answer cards and publish them? That would be a lot more meaningful, would have a lot more depth of information, a lot more perspectives that the users would get, and they can customize their own experience.
It sounds like what you're describing is curated, like personalized, almost like, if I search for something, I could see that result maybe the way that the company frames it on their own website, or like, but I could see it in the way that another, I don't know what the party would be called, but another dart creator would summarize it. They'd say, hey, we think search results are most effectively summarized in this type of framework. So we've almost created our search result library that you could see. Is that kind of what you're describing?
I mean, the creators that I'm talking about have depth of knowledge in a specific domain. So mm-hmm. it could be finance or healthcare or travel or, and each of these, they can produce their own answer cards for specific queries. So if I search for example, for a stock. Now, Google has a nice stock chart and all of that, but that's, whatever knowledge or information that they have. Now, there are other companies that have much bigger and deeper data sets, whether it is FactSet, Bloomberg, or what have mm-hmm. you. And they can create an answer card and the user can decide, do I like the one from FactSet or from Bloomberg? The user gets the choice. They also get deeper information because, Google's built some data sets like for finance or for travel and all of that. But, there are hundreds of domains out there and there are different providers in different domains that have much deeper knowledge and information sets. And, users get more choice, more depth of information. The providers get direct access to the customer that they've never had on the search platform. Users can like or follow a certain provider, and you've made that the default for queries in this particular domain. So, which users have never had a way to customize their own search experience. They get what they get, and that's it.
Super interesting. The closest thing that I can think of to that, and I may be getting this wrong, so forgive me, but a lot of times in AI now we're creating prompts and we're saying, you're a such and such expert and frame these answers from that perspective. And so we're almost trying, I think a lot of us are trying to accomplish in a roundabout way, the thing that you're describing now that you're working on, we want AI to mimic it and you're actually doing it.
Well, AI, even when you say you're a financial expert or, it is still based on, it can only answer questions that it has kind of read or the knowledge that it has scraped from the web. So unless you feed it the best, most in-depth knowledge, it's not going to be able to create intelligent answers. It has good reasoning models, but beyond the reasoning, you have to feed it, the best knowledge or the best information for it to produce the best results.
Yeah, very interesting. Where do you see this headed over the next 3 to 5 years for you?
I would believe that it should be one of the, 3 or 4 most talked about search platforms out there. So we're working on it.
I love it. I love it. What do you need to? What kind of things do you need to put in place to help accomplish that goal to be one of the top 3 or 4 talked about platforms?
So again, going back to my initial thought of, how do we help or identify the problem that a customer has and how to be solved it most effectively. Now, most search engines would say, the customer or the users who are searching for the information. We look at it quite differently. For us, the customer is also the knowledge creator. And what problem are they facing? The biggest problem that they're facing today is that AI can read their content and just summarize it, and they never get the click. The other problem that they face is How do we rank in search results? How do we show up in AI summaries? How do we, you know, how much money do we have to spend to be top of the search results, right? Mm-hmm. So those are the problems that the knowledge creators are facing, the publishers are facing. And I feel like, you know, putting them front and center would be the way to make this a mainstream search engine. You know, we say that, you know, that is why we're partnering with a lot of these providers and creators and publishers to take this to the users. So, our goal is to be a platform where these publishers bring in their information, and you know, it's really their platform. You know, they help us bring this to the actual users.
Yeah,
and those are the relationships that we're working on right now, and I think that is what will get us to become a mainstream product.
And that really does flip the paradigm on its head, doesn't it? Because when you say traditional customers for search are the users, the searching users, that makes sense to me. But you're highlighting the importance of the knowledge creators. Who would be searching for anything if the knowledge wasn't there to be searched, right? And yet the knowledge creators are maybe being, I don't know if you want to say used or abused or just ignored in that process. Yeah. But I can see where that creates an entirely different outlook, a different perspective to as a starting point. To say, well, let's make the knowledge. It's almost more of a media type play, right? Where you see all of Netflix bringing in these podcasters and independent, you know, they're creating their own film, and now they're sourcing with the knowledge creators rather than just providing, you know, intermediary access to something that somebody else created. Does this feel to you in a way that there's a corollary that like the Netflix approach, the Apple approach to media curation?
Absolutely. I mean, it is a two-sided marketplace. You know, you have the creators on one side and the users on the other, and you know, which side do you tackle first, or which is more important? And we believe that it is the creator side that is more important for us, because you know, once you have you know, enough of that knowledge and differentiation, it will be enough of a value add for the users to use that as a replacement for traditional search.
Well, I'm going to be really curious to watch how this progresses for you, because it's actually made me reconsider and think, wait a second, there's a different way to look at search, and that's what you're doing. So that's very intriguing. For those CEOs that are out there that have listened to this episode, that have taken away a few insights and things from the stories that you've shared so far, is there anything else that you would want to share with them, either you know, from a business perspective, personal perspective, to just say, hey, you know, maybe you haven't run your first marathon yet, but while you're on that path, you know, here's a nugget that I would share with you to think about and get you through the hard times.
Yeah, think about starting a company. Very few do. And my advice would be to those who are kind of like on the sidelines, you know, thinking about starting a company, you know, whether, you know, do I quit my job? Is this the right time? Do I have a groundbreaking vision? You know, is this, do I have a co-founder that I could work with? You know, you have all these doubts when you're starting a company. And my advice would be, you know, just jump in. If you feel like, you know, there is an idea that is pulling you, that you're thinking about day in and day out, the timing is never going to be right. You might not have that perfect co-founder. You might not have that perfect environment. You might not have funding lined up. You might be in a cushy job that that you're scared to leave. But there will never be a right time where everything lines up. It just never happens. And to first-time entrepreneurs, I would say entrepreneurship is not something that you will learn through videos or in an MBA class or anywhere. You know, most of entrepreneurship is what you will learn after you become an entrepreneur. So it's going to be on the job, you know, when you're, you know, hit with those daily challenges and how you tackle them. So, so I would just encourage people to take that plunge. It's once you take the plunge, it's not that scary anymore.
I love that. And I want to just highlight something that, because, you know, I don't want to downplay this at all. You know, take the first step, you know, very common advice. What I'm hearing when you say this, though, because, and, you know, I could be wrong, but my perception from listening to the way that you framed that, you set that up to give that advice, I think that goes back to what we talked about with humility. I can, I feel like I can sense humility coming through and even a sense of compassion that you're like, hey, you know, you can do not just like take the first step, action, you know, action dispels fear, but it was like, hey, you can do this. Like it is scary. I feel like you said that from a place of empathy and having been through it and encouraging people in part because they might not, you know, because those are the people who need the encouragement, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So very, very well said, Jeff.
I love that. I love that. Well, because it's been a pleasure having you on the show. You've done some great things and you're continuing to work on some great things. So I'm excited to see where that goes. If there's anything that our audience can do, you know, that if you want them to reach out to you or connect with you or, you know, any resources, is there anything that they can do to help out?
I'm on LinkedIn. You know, folks can reach out on LinkedIn. It's just, there are only a couple of people with my name, the exact same name. But if you put Hyperdart or Nagarro, you'll find me. So reach out through that. Try out Hyperdart, give us feedback. You know, that's where my heart and soul is right now.
I love it. I love it. Well, thank you for taking a little bit of time out of your busy schedule and sharing insights with the audience today. And for the audience members who joined us on this episode, thank you again for being a part of the Breakout CEO podcast.
Thank you so much, Jeff. It was a pleasure.
Be sure to follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And if you enjoy the show, a rating or a review goes a long way. Our mission is to promote the stories of breakout CEOs in scaling SaaS, e-commerce, and tech companies to equip peer CEOs with valuable perspectives and confidence. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of The Breakout CEO. I'm Jeff Holman, and I'll see you next time.